Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Most of us will have several surgical procedures in the course of our lives, from dentistry and cosmetic treatments to assisted childbirth and organ transplants. Surgery is one of the most important sectors in the medical field. Most of us also know something about the innovations and discoveries of the 18th and 19th centuries, the discovery of germs and the understanding of post-surgical infection, and not forgetting, of course, the introduction of general anaesthetic. But what are the centuries before these developments? In England, what was surgery like for the women and men of the 16th and 17th centuries? How were surgeons trained? And what ailments did they treat? How were they regarded? What tools did they use? Did treatment vary depending on your station in society and means? And what was the rate of survival? With me today is Mr. Michael Crumplin, historian, author, and retired surgeon. Mr. Crumplin has written extensively on the history of medicine and surgery during conflict, as well as acting as a historical advisor for film. Mr. Crumplin, welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
Thank you.
Now, we're going to be talking about surgery in the 16th and 17th centuries and thereafter. So I suppose the first thing to ask is, what do we mean when we use the word surgery in terms of this period? What sort of procedures were being done and how was a surgeon different to a physician?
A surgeon is somebody who works with his hands. It's a craft, and the word is derived from kyrie and ergos, two Greek words, which means work of the hand. Therefore, in olden times, in general, surgeons were really designated trade, working a craft, while physicians were very well-educated men, often at Oxbridge, because there were very few universities in these times, you know, just three English and three Scottish. So physicians were honourable, well-paid, respected, and really were very limited in their knowledge, nosology, classification of disease and capabilities. They had drugs and diagnostic abilities, that's about all, but very much considered superior to the surgeon.
So would it be fair to say then that surgery was something that was more available to people of different social ranks than a physician?
Yes, I think so. But then, of course, surgeons who became predominant charged a lot of money and indeed were respected so, and often culled more patients because they charged a lot more money. These were the very top rank of the master surgeons. Physicians were very well off, and I suppose there was some antithesis about this. I know that in the 15th century, there was an effort preceding the barber surgeons to unite the physicians and surgeons, and that lasted just for 1 year. It didn't work. They never got on. A physician would not dirty his hands and cause bleeding and mess. And a surgeon, surprisingly, many of them knew quite a bit about materia medica. So particularly in the armed services, the surgeons did pretty much all the work. Physicians were a rarity and of perhaps some use in public health, diet and disease outbreaks.
You mentioned the barber surgeons then, which is the guild that's established to organise the profession, the Company of Barber Surgeons from 1540. What was a barber surgeon and why did the fields of surgery and grooming overlap?
Well, it's a strange one, really, because you would have thought they'd be quite distinct. But Company of Barbers and the Guild of Surgeons, as it became from the Fellowship of Surgeons, as you say, became united in the mid-16th century by Henry V's charter. And that continued. And I think there was certainly a delineation of which sort of work was done by whom. And I think there were, as things evolved in the Barber Surgeons Company, any barber who would transgress beyond bleeding, lancing, tooth pulling, cutting hair at the very outset would be castigated. And likewise, a surgeon in that company, a barber surgeon, wouldn't particularly groom hair. I mean, I suppose they might occasionally, might have to in surgical procedure, but they were distinct. There was an effort to keep it distinct. I'm sure there were transgressions in each way, but at least by the Barber Surgeons Foundation, there was regulation and ruling, you know.
So what kind of training then could we expect a surgeon to have had?
Well, long before universities that would take surgeons and medical schools, surgeons came really from the middling sort on the whole. That doesn't mean that poorer people didn't become surgeons because somebody picked them up and threw them into the pot because they had some sort of skill. But the training was largely an indentured apprenticeship to a master surgeon, preferably, or an ordinary surgeon. There weren't a huge number in London, and there were some then after scattered through the country. And the licensing procedure, I presume, was mostly through the barber surgeons. But I feel that there would be people coming down from Scotland also, and people perhaps practicing when they had ability. They'd had training from a surgeon in the provinces, but without necessarily getting a license. But there was a licensing procedure, and that's one of the most important developments, I think, in this period.
And how quickly, I suppose, could somebody rise to that status? Does it sort of take the normal amount of time and of apprenticeship and a journeyman, I guess maybe 7 years or something? Or is it quicker than that? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think probably, I mean, later on it was fairly designated as 5 years, but I think here you'd see something between 3 and 5 years. And it would probably be according to the apprentice's abilities and speed of learning. I mean, that's one of the things with modern surgery, that because of the European Working Time Directive, they've cut the hours right down. Some people take longer to train than others. I would think between 3 and 5 years, and they would obviously attend, they would have to attend dissections and demonstrations and lectures at the Barber Surgeons Hall to do it properly.
Anything like that that involves so much skill with your hands is about time on task, isn't it? It's about practice and doing the manoeuvre again and again and again until you've got the delicacy to do it properly.
Yeah, and although surgery was extremely crude at this time and essentially very speedy for obvious reasons to reduce the amount of pain and blood loss and all the rest of it, you're quite right. The best way to learn surgery with due amount of basic learning and reading was to operate under tuition, mentorship, that still applies today. And in the armed services, the field of battle was the school of surgery, absolutely. And the good guys really moved on pretty quickly if they showed some adept digital techniques.
You mentioned dissections there. How much of the learning would have been practical in terms of cadavers? Because I understand that they're starting to be used in mid-century in Europe, but I don't know if that is the case in England at this time.
No. Of course, that's the trouble with all these subjects. They're worldwide, they're European-wide, and they all differ a bit. Certainly in Edinburgh, the incorporation of surgeons were allowed in the early 16th century. One executed criminal's cadaver per annum. That went up to two. But when Henry gave the charter to the barber surgeons in London, they were allowed 4 cadavers per annum. And it was a bit of a business to try and get hold of these. The beadle would have to go out with assistance to stop other people getting the corpses or the family trying to possess it. It was a pretty awful and horrid business. But those 4 cadavers were very precious and nowhere near what they would have needed to train the surgeons. So it became compulsory to attend dissections. And I mean, classically, the reader is the guy who gives instructions to the person who's doing the dissection in front of him. There is nothing more important to a surgeon than a sound knowledge of anatomy, because I suppose really the 16th century was the time when Leonardo produced his 100 dissections and data. Also, Andreas Vesalius, his great publication De Humanis Corporis Fabrica, although it must have been very expensive, was able to be engraved after the Gutenberg printing revolution. And so those books became available in libraries and at places like the Barber Surgeons Hall. I'm not sure how many people of lowly status would be able to afford to buy them. So you had pictures and you had attendance at dissections, and you were fined if you didn't attend them. And the bodies, of course, wouldn't last terribly long. There was no method of preserving them, really. So most dissections were held in the spring, winter, or autumn times.
Yes, one can imagine that summer might not have been such a pleasant time to do it. You mentioned earlier the speed at which these needed to take place. And of course, this is all before the invention of anaesthesia. Did they first of all have an understanding about the need to inhibit sensation? And did they have any methods to do so?
They did. There was derivatives of opium, obviously laudanum being one of the best known, or tincture of opium. Laudanum, I think, was just alcohol mixed with the opium. And then you had things like henbane and mandrake, which were either hallucinogenic or soporific. Not really quite sure how effective they would be as analgesics. Alcohol certainly isn't, unless you're nearly comatose with it. And of course, being comatose means you could vomit or be uncooperative or bleed more. So it was a wretched business. And one has to really understand the philosophy of pain and suffering in these days. I mean, surely in these days, a woman would lose half her children with disease or accident or whatever, and men would go through pain without any relief, any sort of medium type of analgesic, and probably not get any opium. So they were very inured to pain. I wouldn't say that they were braver than us. They just didn't expect it, and it wasn't there. So you do read, when you have operations like cutting for the stone or amputation, of the absolute agony. There are a few 18th, 19th century accounts by patients, and they're pretty awful. But they would just have to deal with it. And in some operations, people had to be restrained very fiercely indeed, for obvious reasons.
Yes, it's so difficult, I imagine, to get documentary evidence about this, because pain is such a difficult thing to describe after the event. So anyone who has survived one of these surgeries can say it was agony or it was painful, but that we can't talk about it in any meaningful way, can we?
No, not really. It's fortunate that memory generally seems to... I've had a lot of major surgery and I don't remember the pain at all. And I think there's a sort of suppression, voluntarily or involuntarily, of it. And it's the same when talking to patients. And think of childbirth too. A mother is soon very happy about having her child and the pain is forgotten. Goodness me, she might have another one in a year's time. Remarkable.
Yes, that certainly seems like a survival mechanism for the human race. Of course, any time someone went into surgery, there were risks. How dangerous was it? I mean, I guess it depends on the procedure, but can you give us some sort of sense of the cost-benefit analysis of surgery at this time? In what circumstances would you submit to it, and what was the possible outcomes?
Well, I think that it's a very important question, that certainly the people who accepted surgery, and there were many who didn't, even into the 19th century, patients would, soldiers, sailors and civilians would refuse an operation and die or not, whatever the stake happened with the decision. But if you imagine somebody like Samuel Pepys, which is within our period, who had a very painful bladder stone, life wasn't worth living. So you'd undergo quarter of an hour of absolute agony. You might faint. Syncope or fainting was quite common in those days. But then to get rid of that stone, even with the complications after stone removal, was probably worth it in the end. It certainly was in Pepys's case. So the cost benefit is very fair comment. I mean, sometimes when you have no symptoms, but say you have a sort of tuberculous knee and it's not particularly painful, to have an above knee amputation had to be explained by the surgeon that if you don't have this done, you know, you're going to die and it's going to spread, or you won't be able to walk or whatever. So yeah, an important question.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
You mentioned earlier that in this period of sustained warfare, that the extreme conditions of field surgery were quite an important testing ground, or perhaps one would call it research and development. You know, what methods and techniques came out of those conditions?
Well, there are some important developments. If I can just adjust the question slightly, the organisation in the new model army, and then by the standing army after the restoration, actually showed a considerable improvement by appointing regimental surgeons, staff surgeons, and field hospitals. So that would automatically slightly increase the chance of survival in itself. You'd have a chief surgeon, apothecary, and physician with the army, and eventually you'd have Kilmainham and Chelsea hospitals for those that had survived crippling injury or surgery. The techniques that gradually developed in the army and navy, one of them was trepanation, or drilling a hole in the skull, either to get access to elevate in-driven, down-driven bits of bone, or release purulent material or blood. The Continentals and early English surgeons used a thing called a brace trepan, and I'm sure any carpenter listening will understand what a brace and bit is. But there was a chap called Woodall who actually invented a trephine, which is really a T-shaped instrument, which you held in one hand. On the bit that came away from your hand, there's a circular saw, which you twisted round to make a little groove in the skull, eventually cutting right through both tables of the bone, having divided the skin to get access to the bone, and then you've got some access into the skull. And I've used these instruments, both types, in animals, in experiments, and there's no doubt that the trephine was a very good instrument. The other thing is tourniquets. Tourniquets were introduced in the 16th century, and then the windlass tourniquet came in first, and then a chap called Petit in about 1716 brought in, so it's just after our period, a thing called the screw tourniquet, which was a strap, canvas strap, and as you tightened a brass screw, the strap tightened. And on the battlefield or at surgery, this would control any egress of blood from the limb at the surgeon or on the battlefield. So tourniquets and the trephine, and then probably there were some instruments, not so much in war, which improved the access for removing bladder stones. If you go through this period and look at instruments, you see how crude they are. They often have very decorative handles made of semi-precious stones or decorated wood or metal. And this is long before sterilization, and made of crude steel. They didn't change all that much. But if you compare the beginning of our period with the end, the instruments were becoming more practical, more refined, and less decorative.
So is it fair to say that the development of surgical tools over that period of time, and indeed as we stretch into the 18th century and so on, came about through a process of trial and error?
Yes, somebody would say, well, I'm uncomfortable with this thing, or it blunts too quickly, let's improve it, and so on. It's interesting to watch old techniques compare with modern. For instance, the amputation knives initially were curved because the technique was to do a beefsteak guillotine amputation, which was very difficult to close over the bone end, as you can imagine, because there was no excess of soft tissue to bring over the bone end. But gradually, flaps were developed by a chap called Young, in the 17th century. And what he did was to change the shape of the knife from curved to straight, and he would pass it straight through the limb, above and below the bone, sequentially, and cut obliquely outwards. Now, if you can imagine that, it would produce a flap. And then you divided the bone after holding the flaps away, and the two flaps would come together and produce a nicely vascularized bit of soft tissue over the bone end. And that's innovation. And then in my day, we didn't have long amputation knives. We used a scalpel. And then that's been superseded by the cutting diathermy. And then the bone is divided now by an oscillating electric saw. But of course, the old days, it was a straight Tenon saw. And that it needed a special technique to divide bone without upsetting the patient too much. So you can see the evolution of surgery through its instruments, and the techniques change.
What's interesting about that is obviously we've got a clear difference there between a circular saw and a straight saw. But are there any of what we might think of as these kind of relatively primitive tools from this period still in use today, but in a modernized version?
Well, it depends what you mean by modern day. In my day, about 25 years ago, we still had handheld Tenon saws, which were fine. We didn't use oscillating saws, which is okay. I mean, it's probably just as quick to go through with a hand saw, but the patient nowadays is asleep, so he doesn't mind what we do in the way of how we divide the bone. Scalpels or bisturies, which is a longer type of scalpel blade, are still in use, yes, of course, but they're disposable now. They were resharpened by the surgical orderly in the old days, or the servant or beadle or whoever, and he had to hone the knives. And I have one set from the 1800, and they are razor sharp, a beautiful steel. That's another thing, that the development of metallurgy went on through this period that we're talking about. Just carbonizing iron is a very old technique. And stainless steel didn't come in till about 1918, 1916, something like that.
So we've been talking chiefly about the 16th and 17th centuries, but let's sort of look on a little bit further, because do we find the surgical methods of this time paving the way for what is developing in the following centuries?
That's the way I look at it. I look at it as stepping stones. If we just sort of think of what was done in this period, I mean, you've got anatomy being printed, learnt, and taught, and regulated. Now, once you've got anatomy, there wasn't much pathology in those days because disease processes were ill understood. But the microscope had been invented. Harvey in 1600s described his circulation of the blood, and Malpighi from Italy described the capillaries. So gradually, we were beginning to understand how the body worked. There's an element of physiology there. There were splenectomies performed on dogs and humans, and they survived without a spleen, although they didn't know what the spleen did. So you've got anatomy and you've got physiology. But obviously, in the next century after ours, in the 18th century, we have the really scientific thinking men like John William Hunter and Desault and all the French surgeons, and they were just taking experimentation and anatomy even further. But really, until 1846 and 1865, which respectively were the discovery and use of ether and then antiseptic surgery by Lister, there was so far you could go. Once that happens and the germ theory comes out, you've then got the causation of disease. You can classify it, you can treat it, you can start trialing an error with antibiotic substances or antibacterial substances and so forth. So until those two factors came about, surgery remained pretty basic, very painful, had to be speedy, was often complicated, but was often survived. I mean, if we look at Baron Larrey and the 1812 French venture into Russia, his total amputation mortality without any of these facilities, and often in very primitive conditions, was 20%. And that means 8 out of 10 men are surviving.
That's a pretty impressive rate, given everything you've just said.
Mind you, caesarean section at this time carried a mortality of about 90%. So there were things that weren't so good.
Yes, I have to say, one of the questions that's often asked of me as a historian is which time I would like to live in. And seeing as neither my child nor I would have survived his birth in previous centuries, I always say now, actually, is when I'd like to live. Thank you.
Well, I think despite all the problems we're going through at the moment, it's just is a system that needs rejigging. It's a very good system. And what impresses me as a retired surgeon is what I hear about and see and sometimes experience by the people who do the job. They are so good, some of them. I mean, you've now got robotic surgeons who are doing nothing but robotic total prostatectomies. And their results are superb.
What does that mean?
The Da Vinci robot is a very sophisticated machine. It's operated at a distance by the surgeon. You gain entrance into the abdominal cavity, you distend it with gas, and you've got a view better than at open surgery. And you've got fine instruments, and you can see planes and how you should dissect what, where there are nerves you shouldn't divide and blood vessels you've got to be careful of. So the people and the equipment that we have are phenomenal. But we in North Wales, for instance, haven't got a robotic machine yet. They must have dozens in London. So it's a very patchy business. But the people who are working in the service, as in these days, there were some remarkably able people. Ambroise Paré never fails to amaze me. He was an amazing chap.
Yes, tell us a little bit about Paré.
Well, he trained. I mean, he came from quite a good family and trained in the Hotel Dieu, then he joined the army in one of his ventures to the siege of Turin. I think it was 1537. The standard technique to cause wounds to heal, reverse the poisonous effect of gunpowder, which didn't exist, and to stop bleeding was to pour hot oil of elder into a wound, boiling oil. And it was the most cruel and dreadful treatment, but it was believed in. So he ran out of oil at Turin. And he just dressed the wounds with, I think, turpentine, rose water, and egg yolk. And the next day, he found his patients calm. Their wounds were fine. They weren't inflamed as much. But you see, how would he get that message to everybody? I mean, Wiseman in the 17th century, another great surgeon, hated cautery with the same vehemence. But not everybody, the information that was emanating from these great thinkers and people who trial and error or whatever, just wasn't getting out there because there weren't any journals. His coterie of people around him would know about it. But, you know, there were no journals till the sort of 1900s in this country in surgery. So sad, but there were some great advances, you know.
I've got two more questions for you. One is perhaps obvious, but I want to ask it all the same. We've been talking about men so far. Do we know of any female surgeons in this period of time?
As far as I know, not in emanating from the UK till Dr. Barry, which was in the 19th century. What women did in villages, midwives, even bone setters and herbalists, were an important contribution to health care. But as qualified barber surgeons or doctors, not to my knowledge. In other countries, I mean, in the Far East, Middle East, I think there were female actual surgeons as well as doctors here and there, but not in this country, to my knowledge, no.
And it's interesting you mentioning midwives there, because one of the things I wondered about is how was surgery received by people as it developed? So, I mean, were people suspicious? Was there a sort of battle for it to be accepted? Was it seen as something not for ordinary people, it was only for the privileged?
It's difficult to know. It's only by reading diaries of prominent surgeons. Hunter's interesting because, although he's later than our period, I'm sure he reflects what would have happened to many of the master barber surgeons, that a surgeon or a doctor from a province would send in a case. But what is striking is that any cases referred to top men were very advanced indeed. So the cancers were advanced, the infection was advanced, the congenital anomaly was huge. And of course, we're dealing now in a society whose, for the ordinary people, lifespan was about 35 to 40. For the aristocrats, it might have crept up to 60. You know, advanced disease made the treatment no easier. And people would try and avoid surgery. I think it was not a happy place to be, unless, as you said earlier, the symptoms were desperate.
One final thought then. I'm struck by the fact that surgeons across time have not only been talented craftsmen, but have had to be unsentimental, sanguine, decisive. And I wonder if, as a retired surgeon yourself, you feel some kindred spirit with these surgeons of the past.
There's been quite a bit of study on emotions and surgery recently, which is quite a complex psychological analysis. I mean, it's easier to relate it to personal experience. I think There is a great empathy with people, but there's a terrific balance. On one hand, you've got a surgeon who is non-empathetic, non-sympathetic, and is just a technician. I'm of the opinion I'd be quite happy to go to him, however rude he is. I mean, my orthopedic surgeon said very little. He was a nice chap, but he had no relationship closely with a patient with a lot of chatter, sitting on the bed and holding hands and so on. And I do know of a surgeon who used to pray with patients before surgery. That's very unusual. But the thing is that you can see this scale. And I think what you need to be as a surgeon is to understand the problem and manage it as if it was a member of your family and not be too over emotional about it. Be very prepared to listen and I think explain the technique and the complications clearly. And then I think things are much easier because it's still a very scary process. Although I have to say, having gone through four major procedures, I have no fear of surgery at all now because the results are generally clear and the technique is usually fine. You get the odd catastrophe, but it probably isn't going to happen to you anyway. I hope that answers your question. It's difficult. Honesty, frankness, and some compassion without being over sentimental is important. The most important thing is to be able to do the operation properly.
Indeed, indeed. Well, thank you so much for your time in talking to us about the sort of origin period, I suppose, of modern surgery and giving us a sense of how it created those stepping stones to today.
Thank you very much for your questions. They were well aimed.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit. And also to my researcher, Alice Smith, my producer, Rob Weinberg, and Ella Blacksall, who edited this episode. We're always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, @NotJustTudors. And do remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released. My new online course, Henry VIII, The Making of a Tyrant, starts this April. Go to learn.susannalipscomb.com to find out more. And as a listener to Not Just the Tudors, I'd like to offer you 10% off the regular price. Use the code NJTT10 at checkout. That's learn.susannalipscomb.com, NJTT10.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.